100 times over. 10 years into my teaching career, 38 years old, and if I'm to assess myself, I'll say, you're doing your dogged best. There are teachers who teach and don't give a fiddler's thought what the students think of them. Subject matter is king. Such teachers are powerful. They dominate their classrooms with personality backed up by the great threat. The red pen inscribing on the report card, the dreaded F. Their message to their students is, I am your teacher, not your counselor, not your confidant, not your parent. I teach a subject. Take it or leave it. I often think I should be a tough, disciplined teacher, organized and focused, a John Wayne of pedagogy, another Irish schoolmaster wielding stick, strap, cane. Tough teachers deliver the goods for 40 minutes, digest this lesson, kids, and be ready to throw it up on exam day. Sometimes I joke, sit in that seat, kid, and be quiet, or I'd break your bloody head. And they laugh because they know, yeah, isn't he something? When I act tough, they listen politely till the spasm passes. They know. I don't see a class as one unit sitting and listening to me. There are faces showing degrees of interest or indifference. It's the indifference that challenges me. Why is that little bastard talking to her when he could be listening to me? Excuse me, James. There's a lesson going on here. Oh, yeah, yeah. There are moments and looks. They may be too shy to tell you that was a good lesson, but you know now, from the way they leave the room and the way they look at you, whether the class was a success or something to be forgotten. The approving looks warm your heart on the train home. No matter what happened in your classroom, there were rules from the officials who supervised the high schools of New York. Children are to keep their voices down. They are not to roam rooms or hallways. There can be no learning in a noisy atmosphere. The classroom is not to be a playground. There should be no throwing of things. If students want to ask a question or answer a question, they are to raise their hands. They must not be allowed to call out. Calling out could lead to pandemonium, and that would make a bad impression on Board of Education officials from Brooklyn or educators visiting from foreign parts. Use of the lavatory pass must be kept to a minimum. Everyone knows the various ploys with the lavatory pass. A boy given the pass to go to the lavatory on the second floor is sometimes found squinting through the window of a room where a girl he has recently fallen in love with is sitting and making loving faces right back. That is not to be tolerated. Some boys and girls use the pass to meet in the basement or on the stairwell, where they are up to no good and found by alert assistant principals who report them and call their parents. Others take the pass to smoke in various secret places. The bathroom pass is for the bathroom, to be used for no other purpose. Students should not stay away with the pass more than 5 minutes. If they do, the teacher is to inform the office of the principal, which would send a dean to inspect the lavatories and other locations to ensure there is no improper behavior. Principals want order, routine, discipline. They prowl the hallways. They peer through the windows and classroom doors. They want to see boys and girls with heads bent over books, boys and girls writing, boys and girls with hands raised, excited, eager to answer teachers' questions. Good teachers run a tight ship. They maintain discipline, and that is crucial in a vocational high school in New York where gangs sometimes bring their problems to school. You have to keep an eye out for gangs. They could take over a whole school, and it's goodbye to learning. Teachers learn, too. After years in the classroom, after facing thousands of teenagers, they have that sixth sense about everyone who enters the room. They see the sidelong glances. They sniff the air of a new class, and they can tell if this is the pain-in-the-ass group, or one they can work with. They see quiet kids who have to be drawn out, and loud mouths who have to be shut up. They can tell by the way a boy sits if he's going to be cooperative or a great pain in the ass. It's a good sign when a student sits straight up, joins his hands on the desk before him, looks at the teacher, and smiles. It's a bad sign if he lounges back, sticks his leg into the aisle, stares out the window at the ceiling, over the teacher's head. Watch out for trouble. In every class, there's a pest put on earth to test you. He usually sits in the last row where he can tilt his chair against the wall. You've already talked to the class about the danger of tilting. Chair could slip, children, and you could be hurt. Then teacher has to write a report in case parents complain or threaten to sue. Andrew knows the tilting chair will annoy you, at least get your attention. Then he can play the little game that will catch the eyes of the girls. You'll say, "Hey, Andrew." He'll take his time. This is a showdown, man, and girls are watching. Wah! This is the teenage sound you won't find in a dictionary. Wah! Parents hear it constantly. It means, "What do you want? Why are you bothering me?" The chair, Andrew. Would you put it down, please? I'm just sitting, minding my own business. The chair, Andrew, has four legs. Tilting on two legs could cause an accident. Silence in the classroom. Showdown time. This time you know you're on fairly safe ground. You feel Andrew is disliked by this group, and he knows he'll get no sympathy. He's a pale, thin figure, a loner. Still, the class is watching. They may not like him, but if you bully him, they'll turn against you. When it's boy versus teacher, they choose boy, and all because of a tilted chair. You could have let it go. No one would have noticed. So, teacher man, what's the problem? Simple. Andrew has shown his dislike for you from day one, and you don't like being disliked, especially by this little shit who's disliked by the rest of the class. Andrew knows you favor the girls. Of course I favor the girls. Give me five classes with a majority of girls and I'm in heaven. Variety, color, games, drama. Andrew waits. The class waits. The chair is cocky in its tilt. Oh, the temptation to grab a leg and pull. His head would slide down the wall and everyone would laugh. I turn away from Andrew. I don't know why I'm turning away and walking to the front of the room, and I certainly don't know what I'll do or say once I reach my desk. I don't want them to think I've backed off, but I know I have to act. Andrew's head rests against the wall, and he's giving me that little smile of contempt. I don't like Andrew's tumbling red hair. The fine features. I don't like the arrogance of his delicacy. Sometimes when I've warmed up to a subject and the class is with me and I'm rolling along, delighted with myself, I look back at his cold stare and wonder if I should try to win him over or destroy him completely. A voice in my head tells me, make something of it. Turn it into a lesson on observation. Pretend you planned the whole thing. And I said to the class, "So, what's going on here?" They stare. They're puzzled. You say, "Imagine you're a newspaper reporter. You walked into this room a few minutes ago. What did you see? What did you hear? What is the story?" Michael speaks up, "No story, just Andrew being an asshole as usual." Andrew loses his little contemptuous smile. And I feel I have him on the run. I won't have to say much. Continue with the leading questions and let the class damn him. I'll wipe that smile off his face forever, the little shit, and he'll tilt no more. I assume my reasonable, objective teacher role. A comment like that, Michael, doesn't give the reader much information. Yeah, but who needs information like that? Is some guy from the Daily News going to walk in here and write this big story about Andrew and the chair and the teacher getting all pissed off? His girlfriend raises her hand. Yes, Diane? She talks to the class. Mr. McCourt is asking us. Asking, Diane. She pauses. She takes her time. She says, see, Mr. McCourt, that's what's wrong with this world. People try to help people, and next thing, other people are trying to correct everything they say. That's very insulting. I mean, it's okay to tell Andrew put his chair down because he could crack his stupid skull. But there's no reason to be correcting the way people talk. You do that, and we're never going to open our mouths in this class. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to tell Andrew put his chair down and not be an ass. She's 16, tall and cool, and her blonde hair hangs down her back in a sophisticated way that reminds me of Scandinavian actresses. I'm nervous when she walks to the back of the room and stands before Andrew. So, look, Andrew, you see what's happening here? There's this big class, over 30 people in this class, and Mr. McCord up there, and you tilt in your chair, and he tells you put it down, but you just sit there with your little smile, Andrew, and who knows what's going on in your head. You're wasting the time of everyone in this class, and what's your problem? The teacher is getting paid to teach and not tell you put your chair down like you were some kid in first grade, right? Right, Andrew? He's still tilting, but he looks at me as if to say, what's going on here? What should I do? He tilts his chair forward till it's flat. He stands and faces Diane. See? You'll never forget me, Diane. You'll forget this whole class. You'll forget the teacher, Mr. What's-his-name. But I tilt my chair, and the teacher gets uptight, and everyone in this class will remember me forever. Right, Mr. McCourt? I wanted to drop the reasonable teacher mask and say what was on my mind. Look, you little twerp. Put the chair down. I'll throw you out the damn window so you'll be meat for pigeons. You can't talk like that. You'd be reported to the authorities. You know your role. If the little buggers piss you off from time to time, suffer, man, suffer. No one is forcing you to stay in this miserable, underpaid profession, and there's nothing to keep you from going through that door to the shimmering world of powerful men, beautiful women, cocktail parties uptown, satin sheets. Yeah, Teach, what would you do in the great world of powerful men, etc.? Get back to work. Talk to your class. Address the problem of the tilted chair. It's not over. They're waiting. Listen. Are you listening? They smile. There he goes again with his old, listen, are you listening? They call to one another in the hallways, mimicking. Listen, are you listening? It means they like you. I said, you saw what happened in this room. You saw Andrew tilting his chair, and you saw what happened when I told him drop it. So you have material for a story, don't you? We've had conflict. Andrew versus teacher. Andrew versus the class. Andrew versus himself. Oh, yes, indeed. Andrew versus himself. You were making mental notes, weren't you? Or else you just said, why is the teacher making such a big deal about Andrew and his chair? Or why is Andrew being such a pain in the ass? If you were reporting this, there's another dimension to the incident. Andrew's motivation. Only he knows why he was tilting that chair. And you are entitled to speculate. We could have over 30 speculations in this class. Next day, Andrew lingered after class. Mr. McCord, you went to NYU, right?
I did.
Well, my mother said she knew you.
Really?
I'm happy to know that someone remembered me. I mean, she knew you outside her class.
Again.
Really?
She died last year. She had cancer. Her name was June.
Oh, Christ. Slow on the uptake is hardly the word for it. Late bloomer, why didn't I guess? Why didn't I see her in his eyes? She used to say she was going to call you, but she had a bad time with the divorce,
and then the cancer came, and when I told her I was in your class, she made me promise never to tell you about her. She said you'd never want to talk to her anyway. But I did want to talk to her. I wanted to talk to her forever. Who did she marry? Who's your father? I don't know who my father is. She married Gus Peterson. I have to go and empty out my locker. My dad is moving to Chicago, and I'm going with him, my stepmother. Isn't it funny how I have a stepfather and a stepmother and it's okay? We shook hands and I watched him walk down the hallway. Before he turned into the locker area, he turned and waved, and I had a moment wondering if I should let the past go that easily. School wisdom says, unless you can back it up, never threaten a class or an individual. And don't be such a fool as to threaten Benny Boom Boom Brandt, who was famous in the school for having a black belt in karate. After an absence of 4 days, he saunters into the classroom halfway through a lesson on foreign words in English. Amen, pasta, chef, sushi, limousine, and the words that start the tittering. Lingerie, bidet, brassiere. I could ignore Boom Boom, carry on with the lesson, and let him go to his seat, but I know the class is watching and thinking. How come we have to bring in excuse notes when we're absent, but Boom Boom can come in just like that and sit down? They're right, and I'm with them. And I have to show I'm not soft. Excuse me. I'm trying to be sarcastic. He stops just inside the door. Yeah? I play with a piece of chalk to show how cool I am. I struggle to decide between where are you going and just where do you think you're going. The first sentence could sound like a simple question with a hint of teacher authority. The think in the second suggests challenge and could cause trouble. Either way, it's the tone of voice that matters. I back off a little. Excuse me, do you have a pass? You need a pass from the office after an absence. This is the teacher talking. He represents authority, the office down the hall that issues passes for everything, the principal, the superintendent, the mayor, the president, God. This is not the role I want. I'm here to teach English, not to ask for passes. Brandt says, who's going to stop me? He sounds almost friendly, genuinely curious. But what comes from the class is a gasp. Oh, shit, says Ralphie Boyce. High school teachers are urged by their superiors to discourage profanity in the classroom. Such language is disrespectful and could lead to a breakdown in law and order. I want to admonish Ralphie, but can't, because the words leaping around my own head are, oh, shit. Brandt stands with his back to the door that has swung shut behind him. He seems patient. And what is this sudden warmth I feel for this lumbering future plumber from Delancey Street, Manhattan? Is it the patient way he waits, almost gentle in his look? He seems so reasonable and thoughtful, so why don't I drop my tough teacher act and tell him, oh, all right, sit down, Brandt. Forget the past now and try to remember it next time. But I've pushed too far to turn back. His classmates are witnesses, and something has to happen. I toss the chalk into the air and catch it, Brandt watching. I step toward him. This is not my day to die, but class is waiting, and it's time to answer his question. Who's going to stop me? I toss the chalk, perhaps for the last time ever, and tell him, I am. He nods as if to say, that's reasonable. You're the teacher, man. The warm feeling is back, and I have the urge to pat his shoulder, tell him forget the whole thing. Just sit down, Brandt. I toss the chalk again and miss it. It's on the floor. It's imperative that that chalk be retrieved. I bent to pick it up, and there, inviting me, is Brandt's foot, offering itself. I grab it and pull. Brandt falls backward, bangs his head on the brass doorknob, slides to the floor, rests quietly as if contemplating the next move. Again, there's a gasp from the class. Wow! He rubs the back of his head. Is he preparing himself to deliver a quick punch, chop, kick. Shit, Mr. McCourt. I didn't know you was karate. It appears I am the winner. And the next move is mine. Okay, Benny. You can sit down. May. What? All the teachers say you may sit down. Boom Boom is correct in my grammar. Am I in a madhouse? Okay, you may sit down. So, you don't want to pass or nothing? No, it's all right. So, we was fighting for nothing? On the way to his seat, Boom Boom steps on the chalk and looks at me. Was that deliberate? Should I make an issue of it? No. A voice in my head tells me, get on with the lesson, stop acting like a teenager. This kid could break you in two. Teacher man, get back to the lesson on foreign words in English. Brandt acts as if nothing had ever happened between us. And I feel such a wave of shame, I want to apologize to the whole class and to him in particular. I berate myself for the cheapness of what I've done. Now they admire what they think are my karate ways. I open my mouth and babble. Imagine what the English language would be like if you removed French words. You wouldn't be able to order your chauffeur to bring your limousine around anymore. You'd have to say underwear instead of lingerie. You couldn't go to a restaurant, no more cuisine, no more gourmet, no sauce, menu, chef, perfume. You'd have to find a new word for brassiere. Whisper, whisper, giggle, giggle. Ooh, Mr. McCourt, what you said. That's how to get their minds off the incident. I seem to be winning on all fronts, till I look over at Brandt. His eyes seem to say, okay, Mr. McCourt, I guess you needed to look good, so it's okay with me. He was bright enough to pass the New York State Regents exam in English. He could have written a passable and passing English essay, but he chose to fail. He ignored the suggested list of topics, headed his essay, Chirp, and wrote 350 times, Chirp, 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 Chirp. I meet Boom Boom on Delancey Street after graduation and ask him, what was all that about the chirp? I don't know. I get crazy feelings, and I don't care what happens. I was in that classroom, and everything seemed so stupid. That monitor teacher up there warning us not to look at anyone else's paper. And there was this bird on the windowsill chirping away, and I said, okay, shit, what the hell? So I put down what he was saying. When I was 14, my dad sent me to take martial arts. The Japanese guy just let me sit on a bench outside for an hour. And when I said, yo, mister, what about the lesson? He told me, go home. Home? I mean, he was getting paid for the hour. He said, go home. I said, should I come back next week? And he said, nothing. I came back next week and he said, what do you want? I told him again I wanted to learn martial arts. He told me, go clean the toilet. I wondered what that had to do with martial arts, but I said nothing. I cleaned the toilet. He told me, sit on the bench. Take off my shoes and socks and look at my feet. Don't take my eyes off my feet. You ever look at your feet? I have one foot that's bigger than the other. He came out and said, put your shoes on, no socks, and go home. It was getting easy to do what he told me. I stopped being pissed off. Sometimes I sit on that bench and do nothing and just go home and still pay him. I told my dad, but he only made a face. It was 6 weeks before the Japanese guy brought me into the room for my first lesson. He made me stand with my face stuck against the wall while he kept coming at me for about 15 minutes with some kind of sword and screaming at me. At the end of that session, he said I was accepted into his school, except that I had to clean the toilet before I went home that day in case I had any big ideas about myself. So I knew what was going on that day when you pulled my leg. I knew you had to save your ass, and that was okay with me because I didn't need that world, and you're an okay teacher, and I didn't give a shit what those kids in the class thought. If you have to act like a big-ass teacher, you should go home and clean the toilet. This is the situation in the public schools of America. The farther you travel from the classroom, the greater your financial and professional rewards. Get the license. Teach for 2 or 3 years. Take courses in administration, supervision, guidance, and with your new certificates, you can move to an office with air conditioning, private toilets, long lunches, secretaries. You won't have to struggle with large groups of pain-in-the-arse kids. Hide out in your office, and you won't even have to see the little buggers. But here I was, 38 years old, lacking ambition to climb in the school system, adrift in the American dream, facing the midlife crisis, failed teacher of high school English, but hindered by superiors, principals and their assistants. Or so I thought. I had the angst and didn't know what ailed me. Alberta said, "Why don't you get your PhD and rise in the world?" I said, "I will." New York University said yes. They'd accept me for the doctoral program, but my wife said, "Why don't you go to London or Dublin?" "Are you trying to get rid of me?" She smiled. When I was 16, I visited Dublin with a friend on a day trip, and I stood with my back to a grey stone wall to watch a parade. The grey wall belonged to Trinity College, and I didn't know that was looked on as foreign territory, English and Protestant. Farther down the street, iron railings and a great gate kept out the likes of me. There were statues outside of Edmund Burke and Oliver Goldsmith. "Oh," I said, "there he is, right up there, the man who wrote The Deserted Village, which I had to memorize in school." My friend from Limerick, who knew more about the world than I did, said, "Take a good look at Oliver and the rest of it, because your type will never step inside those gates." The Archbishop said any Catholic who goes to Trinity is automatically excommunicated. Any time I visited Dublin after that, I was drawn to Trinity. I stood by the gate admiring the elegant way the students tossed their flapping Trinity scarves over their shoulders. I admired the accents that sounded English. I coveted the beautiful Protestant girls who would never cast me a glance. They'd marry their own kind, their own class of people, all Protestants with horses, and if the likes of me ever married one of them, he'd be booted out of the Catholic Church with no hope of redemption. American tourists in their bright clothes strolled in and out of the college, and I wished I had the courage to walk in myself, but the man at the gate might ask me what I was doing there, and I wouldn't know what to say. 6 years later, I returned to Ireland in my American Army uniform, which I thought would bring respect. It did, till I opened my mouth. I tried to put on an American accent to go with the uniform. It didn't work. At first, waitresses would rush to lead me to a table, but when I spoke, they said, "Arra, Jesus, you're not a Yank at all. You're just Irish like everyone else. Where are you from?" I tried to pass myself off as a GI from Alabama, but one woman in Bewley's Cafe on Grafton Street said, "If you're from Alabama, I'm the Queen of Romania." I stammered and admitted I was from Limerick, and she gave up all claim to the throne of Romania. She said it was against the rules of Bewley's to be chatting up the customers, but I looked like the type that might take a drink. I bragged about how I drank beer and schnapps all over Bavaria, and she said if that was the case, I could buy her a sherry at McDay's pub up the street. I didn't think she was attractive, but it was very flattering that a waitress at Bewley's would want to have a drink with me. I went to McDade's bar to wait for her. The drinkers stared at me and nudged one another over my American uniform, and I felt uncomfortable. The barman stared too, and when I asked for a pint, he said, "Is it a general we have here, or what?" I didn't understand the sarcasm, and when I said, "No, I'm a corporal," there was a wave of laughter along the bar, and I felt like the greatest fool in the world. I was confused. I was born in America. I grew up in Ireland. I returned to America. I'm wearing the American uniform. I feel Irish. They should know I'm Irish. They should not be mocking me. When the waitress from Bewley's arrived and sat with me against the wall and asked for a sherry, there was more staring and nudging. The barman winked and said something about another victim. He came from behind the bar and asked if I'd like another pint. Of course I'd like another pint. All the attention I was getting made my face feel hot, and I knew from looking in the great mirror my eyes were fire engine red. The waitress said if the barman was bringing me another pint, he might as well bring her another sherry after her exhausting day at Bewley's. She told me her name was Mary. She said if I was inclined to look down my nose at her because she was only a waitress, I could stop right there. After all, what was I but a culture from the country, all togged out in my American uniform, putting on airs? The sherry seemed to make her talkative, and the more she talked, the more snickering there was in the seats along the wall. She said her job at Bewley's was temporary. She was waiting for the solicitors to settle her grandmother's will, and when it was decided, she'd open a little shop on Grafton Street and sell delicate garments to a better class of people. I knew nothing about delicate garments, but I wondered about her in such a shop. She was fat, eyes buried in the folds of her face, and she had chins that hung and swung. Her body bulged everywhere. I didn't want to be with her and didn't know what to do. I could see people were laughing at me, and I blurted out of desperation that I had to go. "What?" she said. I have to look at Trinity College. The inside of it. I have to go through the gate. My third pint of stout was talking. "That's a Protestant place," she said. "I don't care. I have to go through the gate." "Did you hear that?" she said to the whole bar. "He wants to go inside Trinity." "Ah, Jesus," said one man, and another said, "Mother of God." "All right, General," said the barman. "Go on. Go to Trinity and look inside, but make sure you got the confession on Saturday." "Did you hear that?" said Mary. "Confession on Saturday. But don't worry, darling. I'll hear your confession any time. Come on, finish your pint and we'll go to Trinity." Oh, God, she wants to go with me. Plump, quivering Mary wants to walk down Grafton Street with me in my American Army uniform. People will say, "Look at the Yank. Is that the best he can do, picking up a great tub of lard like that when Dublin has the loveliest girls in the world?" I told her she shouldn't bother, but she insisted, and the barman said I had more than one reason for confession on Saturday, because your one there shows no mercy. Why didn't I show my independence? Was I to walk through the gates of Trinity the first time in my life with this babbling fat body on my arm? I was, and I did. All the way down Grafton Street, she jabbered at anyone who even looked at us. "What's up with you? Didn't you ever see a Yank before?" Till one woman in a shawl said back to her, "We did, but we never saw one sink so low in the world he had to walk with the likes of you." Mary screamed if she didn't have more important business to attend to, she'd tear the eyes from the shawlie's head. I felt nervous about going through the Trinity Gate. The man in uniform would surely ask what I was doing there, but he paid no attention, even when Mary said, "Lovely evening, darling." There I was at last, standing on the cobblestones, inside the gate, not daring another step. Oliver Goldsmith walked here, Jonathan Swift walked here, all the rich Protestants down the centuries walked here. Here I was, inside the gates, and that was enough. Mary pulled at my arm. "'Tis getting dark. Are you going to stand here all night? Come on, I'm dying for a sherry. Then we go to my little bed sit, and who knows what'll happen, who knows?" She giggled and pulled me against her great, soft, jiggling body, and I wanted to tell Dublin, "No, no, she's not mine." We walked up Nassau Street, where she stopped to admire jewellery at the Yates shop at the corner. "Lovely," she said, "lovely. Oh, the day will come, I'll have one of them rings on my finger." She dropped my arm to point at a ring in the window. And I ran. Away up Nassau Street I ran, barely hearing her scream that I was a dirty Limerick jackeen of a Yank. I returned to Bewley's next day to tell her how sorry I was over my behavior. She said, "Oh, that's all right. Sure, you never know what's going to come out of you after a few sherries or pints." She said she'd be finished at 6, and if I liked, we could go out for fish and chips and have tea later in her room. After the tea, she said it was surely too late for me to walk back to my hotel off Grafton Street, and it wouldn't bother her one bit if I stayed and took the bus with her in the morning. She went to the hallway lavatory, and I undressed down to my underwear. She returned in a gray, billowing nightdress. She dropped to her knees by the bed, blessed herself, and asked God to come between her and all harm. She told God she knew she was putting herself in the way of temptation, but sure, wasn't he an innocent, the boy in the bed? She rolled in and squashed me against the wall, and when I reached to pull up her nightdress, she slapped my hand away. She said she didn't want to be responsible for the loss of my soul, but if I said a perfect act of contrition before I fell asleep, she'd feel easier in her mind. While I was saying the prayer, she wriggled out of the nightdress and pulled me against her body. She whispered I must finish the prayer later, and I said I would. Indeed I would, as I pushed into her vast, blubbery body and finished my act of contrition. I was 22 then, and now, at 38, I was applying to Trinity College. Yes, they'd consider my application if I sat for the American Graduate Record Examination. I did, and astonished myself and those around me with a score in the 99th percentile in English. That meant I was up there with smart people all around the country, and it gave me such a lift. I went to Gage and Tallner's restaurant in Brooklyn, ate a sea bass with a baked potato, and drank so much wine I had no memory of going home. Alberta was patient with me, did not upbraid me in the morning because, after all, I was going to Dublin, to a superior university. And she wouldn't be seeing much of me in the next 2 years, the time Trinity gave you to write and defend a dissertation. In the mathematics section of the GRE, I had, I think, the lowest score in the world. Alberta booked me a berth on the Queen Elizabeth, the ship's second-last eastward voyage on the Atlantic. We had a party on the ship because that's what you're supposed to do. We drank champagne, and when it was time for visitors to go ashore, I kissed her, and she kissed me back. I said I'd miss her, and she said she'd miss me. But I'm not sure either of us was telling the truth. I was lightheaded from the champagne, and when the ship pulled away from the pier, I waved without knowing what I was waving at. That was my life, I thought, waving without knowing what I was waving at. That seemed like the kind of deep observation that could be explored, but it gave me a headache, and I moved on. The ship pulled into the Hudson and headed for the Narrows. I made sure I was on deck to wave to Ellis Island. Everyone waved at the statue, but I had a special wave for Ellis Island, the place of hope and heartbreak. I thought of myself, little fella, nearly 4 years old, 34 years ago, waving, waving, sailing to Ireland, and here I was again, waving. And what was I doing? Where was I going? And what was it all about? When you're alone and still unsteady from champagne, you wander the ship, exploring. I'm on the Queen Elizabeth, sailing to Dublin, to Trinity College, if you don't mind. Did you ever think, with your comings and goings, with all that waving, you'd be joining the enemy? Trinity College, the Protestant college, loyal always to this majesty and that majesty, and what did Trinity ever contribute to the cause of freedom? But down there in your sniffling little soul, you always saw them as superior, didn't you? Horse Protestants with their la-di-da accents, their noses in the air. Oliver St. John Gogarty was a Trinity man, and even though I wrote about him and read every word of his I could find, thinking some of his talent and style would rub off on me, it was all for nothing. I once showed my thesis to Stanley Garber, a teacher at McKee, and told him of my hopes. He shook his head and said, "Look, McCourt, forget Gogarty. In the back of your brain, you'll always be that little pissy-ass kid from the lanes of Limerick. Find out who the hell you are. Climb the cross and do your own suffering. No substitutions, pal." "How can you talk like that, Stanley? That stuff about the cross, you're Jewish." "That's right, look at us. We tried to fit in with the Goyim. We tried to assimilate, but they wouldn't let us. What happens then? Friction, man, and friction throws up people like Marx and Freud and Einstein and Stanley Garber. Thank God you're not assimilated, McCourt, and drop Gogarty. You're not Gogarty. You are on your own. Do you understand that? If you keeled over and died this minute, the stars in their courses would still be stars in their courses, and you'd be a blip. Go your own way, or you'll wind up in a little house in Staten Island saying Hail Marys with a Maureen. I couldn't think about that because here, descending that grand central staircase of the Queen Elizabeth, was a woman I knew. She saw me and said we should have a drink. I remembered she was a private nurse to the rich of New York, and I wonder what else she was. She said she was disappointed over her friend who changed her travel plans, and here she was, the nurse, with a first-class cabin with 2 beds and 5 days of lonely travel before her. The drink loosened my tongue, and I told her of my lonesomeness and how we could be company for each other on the voyage, though it might be difficult with her being first class and me down below the waterline. Oh, that would be grand, she said. She was half Irish and sometimes talked like that. If I'd been sober, I might have been wiser, but I felt the temptation and forgot my own berth in the bowels of the ship. On the third day of the crossing, I slipped away for breakfast in the dining room, my first visit. The waiter said, "Yes, sir," and I felt foolish telling him I didn't know where to sit. "Sir, haven't you been here before?" "No." Because he was a waiter, he did not ask the obvious question, nor did the purser, who said I'd been declared officially not aboard. The ship assumed I'd gone ashore with my friends in a fit of enthusiasm. You could see he was waiting for an explanation, but I could never tell him of my first-class cabin experiences with the private nurse. He said yes, there was a seat for me, and welcome to breakfast. There were 2 bunks in that cabin below the waterline. My cabin mate was on his knees, praying. He looked shocked when he saw me. He was a Methodist from Idaho, sailing to Heidelberg to study theology. So I could not brag to him that I'd spent the last 3 nights in a first-class cabin with a private nurse from New York. I apologized for interrupting his prayer, but he said you could never interrupt his prayer, as his whole life was a prayer. I thought that was a wonderful thing to say, and wished my whole life could be a prayer. What he said gave me a pang of conscience. It made me feel worthless and sinful. His name was Ted. He looked clean-cut and cheerful. He had fine-looking teeth and a marine crew cut. His white shirt was crisp, starched, pressed. He was at ease with himself, at peace with the world. God was in his heaven, a Methodist heaven, and all was right. I felt intimidated. If his life was a prayer, what was mine? One long sin? If this ship hit an iceberg, Ted would be out on the deck singing, "Nearer, my God, to thee," and I'd be searching the ship for priests to hear my last confession. Ted asked if I was religious, if I attended church. He said I was welcome to join him in an hour at a Methodist service, but I mumbled, "I go to Mass occasionally." He said he understood. How could he? What does a Methodist know about the sufferings of a Catholic, especially an Irish Catholic? I didn't say that, of course. I didn't want to hurt his feelings. He was so sincere. He asked if I'd like to pray with him, and I mumbled again. I didn't know any Protestant prayers, and besides, I had to take a shower and change my clothes. He gave me what writers call a penetrating look, and I felt he knew everything. He was only 24, but already he had faith, vision, direction. He might have heard of sin, but you could see he was free of it, clean in every way. I told Ted that after my shower, I would find the Catholic chaplain and attend Mass. He said, "You don't need Mass. You don't need a priest. You have your faith, your Bible, 2 knees and a floor to pray on." That made me feel cranky. Why can't people leave people alone? Why do people feel they have to convert the likes of me? No, I did not want to drop to my knees and pray with the Methodists. Even worse, I didn't want to go to Mass or confession or anything else when I could go up there, walk the deck, sit in the chair, and watch the horizon rise and fall. Oh, the hell with it, I said, and took my shower, thinking of horizons. I thought horizons were better than people. They didn't bother other horizons. When I came out, Ted was gone, his belongings neatly laid out in his bunk. Up on deck, the private nurse came sailing along in the arms of a short, plump, grey-haired man in a navy blue double-breasted blazer with a pink ascot ballooning from his Adam's apple. She pretended she didn't see me, but I stared so hard she had to give me a little nod. She passed on, and I wondered if she waggled her arse deliberately to torment me. Waggle on. I don't care. But I cared. I felt destroyed, cast aside. After her 3 days with me, how could that nurse go off with that old man who was at least 60? What about the time sitting up in bed drinking bottles of white wine? What about the time I scrubbed her back in the tub? What was I to do with myself in the 2 days before the ship docked in Ireland? I'd have to lie in the top bunk with the Methodist praying and sighing below me. The nurse didn't care. She deliberately crossed my path on different decks to make me miserable. And when I thought about her, that old man, it made me disgusted to think of his ancient, wrinkled body next to hers. The next 2 days it was darkness on the high seas as I stood at the rail and thought of jumping into the Atlantic Ocean, down to the bottom with all the ships that were sunk during the war, battleships, submarines, destroyers, freighters. And I wondered if an aircraft carrier was ever sunk. That got me off my misery for a while, wondering about the aircraft carriers and bodies below floating and bumping against the bulkheads. But the misery came back. When you're wandering around the ship with nothing to do but run into a nurse you spent 3 days with, and she with an old man with a double-breasted blazer, you're inclined to think little or nothing of yourself. If I jumped into the Atlantic, it might give her something to think about, but it wouldn't do me any good because I'd never know. I stood at that rail, with the ship whooshing along, thinking about my life and what a poltroon I was. That was one of my favorite words at the time, and it was apt. Poltroon. All I did from the day I arrived in New York to this day on the Queen Elizabeth was meander from one thing to another. Emigrate. Work at dead-end jobs, drink in Germany and New York, chase women, sleep through 4 years at New York University, drift from one teaching job to another, marry, and wish I was single, have another drink, hit a cul-de-sac in teaching, sail for Ireland with the hope that life would behave itself. I wished I could be part of those jolly traveling groups on land or sea who play ping-pong and shuffleboard, and then go off for a drink and who knows what else, but I didn't have the talent. In my head I practiced and rehearsed. Oh, hi, I'd say. How's it going? And they'd say, fine. And by the way, won't you join us for a drink? And I'd say, why not? With an air of insouciance. That was another of my favorite words at the time because it was what I was aiming at and because I liked the sound of it. If I had a few drinks, the insouciance might come. In my charming Irish way, I'd be the life of the party, but I didn't want to leave the rail and the comfort of ending it all. 38 was on my mind, aging teacher sailing to Dublin, still a student. Is that any way for a man to live? I forced myself onto a deck chair for a mid-Atlantic crisis meeting with myself, closed my eyes to shut out the ocean and the sight of the nurse. I couldn't block out the click-clack of her high heels and the American guffaw of Mr. Ancient Ascot. If I had any kind of intelligence beyond the mere sniffing survival skills, I would have attempted an agonizing reappraisal of my life. But I had no talent for introspection. After all those years of confession and limerick, I could examine my conscience with the best of them. This was different. Mother Church was no help here. On that deck chair, I could barely venture beyond the catechism. I was beginning to understand that I did not understand, and digging into myself and my miseries made my head hurt. A 38-year-old in a mess and didn't know what to do about it. That's how ignorant I was. Now I know you're encouraged to blame everyone but yourself for everything. Parents, the miserable childhood, the church, the English. People in New York, Alberta especially, told me, you need help. I knew they were saying, you're obviously disturbed, you should see a shrink. She insisted. She said I was impossible to live with and made an appointment for me with a psychoanalyst on East 96th Street, Shrink Row. The man's name was Henry, and I got off on the wrong foot. When I told him he looked like Jeeves, he said, who's Jeeves? And he wasn't pleased when I told him about that P.G. Woodhouse character. He raised his eyebrows in a Jeevesian way, and I felt like a fool. Besides, I did not know what this was all about, what I was doing in that office. I knew from psychology classes at NYU that the mind had various parts, the conscious, the unconscious, the subconscious, the ego, the id, the libido, and maybe other little nooks and crannies where demons lurked. That was the extent of my knowledge, if it was knowledge at all. Then I wondered why I was paying money I could barely afford to sit opposite this man who scribbled in a notebook at chin level, stopping occasionally to stare at me as if I were a specimen. He rarely spoke, and I felt I had to fill in the silences, or we'd just sit there gawking at each other. He never even said, and how do you feel about that, the way they do in the movies? When he closed his notebook, I knew the session was over, and it was time for his fee. At the start, he told me he would not charge me the full rate. I'd be getting the poor teacher discount. I wanted to tell him I wasn't a charity case, but I rarely said what was on my mind anyway. His routine made me feel uncomfortable. He'd come into the waiting room and stand. That was my signal to get up and walk into the consultation room. He never offered to shake hands, never passed the time of day. I wondered if it was my job to say hello or stick out my own hand, and if I did, how he would judge it. Would he say I was doing it out of my massive sense of inferiority? I didn't want to give him the kind of ammunition where he could decide I was a lunatic, like certain ancestors in my family. I wanted to impress him with my cool demeanor, my logic, and, if possible, my wit. On the first visit, he watched while I tried to decide what to do with myself. Would this be like confession? Examination of conscience? Should I sit in that tall, high chair? Or should I lie on the couch the way they do it in the movies? If I sat in the chair, I'd have to face him for 50 minutes, but if I stretch out in the couch, I could look at the ceiling and avoid his eyes. I sat in the chair, and he sat in his chair, and I felt relieved there was no sign of disapproval on his face. After a few visits, I wanted to quit, walk over to a Third Avenue bar for the serenity of an afternoon beer. I didn't have the courage, or I wasn't angry enough yet. Week after week, I sat and babbled in my chair, sometimes twice a week because he said I needed more frequent attention. I wanted to ask him why, but I was beginning to understand that his method was to make me figure it out for myself. If that's the case, I asked myself, why am I paying him? Why couldn't I sit in Central Park and look at trees and squirrels and let my troubles swim to the surface? Or why couldn't I sit in a pub, have a few beers, look inward, examine my conscience? That would save hundreds of dollars. I wanted to come right out with it and say, Doctor, what's wrong with me? Why am I here? I'd like a diagnosis for all the money I'm paying you, even if you're giving me the poor teacher discount. If you put a name on my ailment, I might be able to look it up and figure out a cure. I can't be coming in here week after week, blathering about my life, and not knowing whether I'm at the beginning or the middle or the end. Oh, I could never talk to the man like that. I wasn't brought up like that. Wouldn't be polite and he might be offended. I wanted to look good, didn't want him to feel sorry for me. Surely he could see how reasonable and balanced I was despite my struggle with a troubled marriage and my aimlessness in the world. He scribbled away in his notebook, and even though he never showed it, I think he had a good time with me. I told him about my life in Ireland and in the classroom. I did my best to be lively and entertaining, to assure him all was well. I didn't want to upset him in any way, but if all was well, what was I doing there in the first place? I wanted to make him respond, one little smile, one little word to show his appreciation for my efforts, nothing. He won. He carried the day. Then he startled me. He said, "Uh-huh," dropped his notebook to his lap, and stared at me. I was afraid to speak. What had I said to trigger this "uh-huh"? "I think you've hit pay dirt," he said. Oh, another pay dirt moment. The chairman at Fashion Industries High School had complimented me on hitting pay dirt with my lesson on the parts of the sentence. All I had said before the "aha" was that outside of my high school classes, I felt shy with people. In groups, I could hardly talk unless I had a few drinks, unlike my wife or my brother, who could march up to people and get into lively conversations. That was the pay dirt. After the "aha," he said, "You might benefit from participation in a group. Might be a step forward if you interacted with other people. We have a small group here. You'd be number 6. I didn't want to be number 6. I didn't know what interacting meant. Whatever it was, I didn't want to do it. How could I tell him the way I felt, that this was all a waste of time and money? I had to be polite no matter what. 6 weeks blathering in this chair and I felt worse than ever. When would I be able to walk up to people and chat in that easy Alberta Maliki way? My wife said it was a good idea, even if it cost more money every week. She said I lacked certain social skills, that I was a little rough around the edges, that group work might lead to a big breakthrough. That led to a quarrel that lasted for hours. Who was she to tell me I was rough around the edges, like some Mick fresh off the boat with bog mud on his brogues? I told her I was not going to spend hours with a bunch of New York loonies whining about their lives and trotting out intimate secrets. Bad enough I spent my youth whispering my sins to priests who yawned and made me promise never to sin again for fear of offending poor Jesus suffering up there on the cross for my sins. Now she and the shrink wanted me to blab again. No! She said she was sick of hearing about my miserable little Catholic childhood. I didn't blame her. I was sick of my miserable childhood, too, the way it followed me across the Atlantic and kept nagging at me to be made public. Alberta said if I didn't continue my therapy, I was in deep trouble. Therapy? What do you mean? That's what you're getting. And if you don't stick with it, this marriage is over. That was tempting. If I was single again, I'd be free to wander Manhattan. I could have said, "All right, the marriage is over," but I let it go. Even if I were free, what woman in her right mind would have me anyway? A meandering, rough around the edges pedagogue blabbing his life away to a Jeeves on East 96th Street? I thought of an Irish saying, "Contention is better than loneliness," and stayed where I was. They said shocking things in that group. There was talk of sex with fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, visiting uncles, a rabbi's wife, an Irish setter, sex with a jar of chicken liver, sex with a man who came to fix the refrigerator and stayed for days with his clothes dropped on the kitchen floor. These were things you'd reveal only to a priest. But these group people didn't mind telling their secrets to the world. I knew a bit about sex. I'd read the Kama Sutra, Lady Chatterley's Lover, and the 120 Days of Sodom of the Marquis de Sade, but they were only books, and all in the imagination of the authors, I thought. D.H. Lawrence and the Marquis himself would have been shocked if they'd sat in this group. We sat in a semicircle with Henry facing us, scribbling away in his notebook, occasionally nodding. Then one day there was a silence, after one man talked about going to Mass and taking the communion wafer home to masturbate on it. He said that was his way of severing all connection with the Roman Catholic Church, and what he did was so thrilling, he often repeated that little act just for the fun. He knew there wasn't a priest in the world who would give him absolution for such an abomination. This was my fourth session with this group, and I hadn't said a word. At that moment, I wanted to get up and walk out. I wasn't much of a Catholic anymore, but I would never think of using a communion wafer for my sexual enjoyment. Why didn't that man simply quit the church and go about his business? Henry knew what I was thinking. He stopped scribbling and asked me if there was anything I wanted to say.